Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
30 years of Double D Ranch. Known for its high style and iconic fashion tributes to the West, the Double D Ranch brand has garnered admirers from every walk of life. Celebrating 30 years in business, founders Audrey Franz and Cheryl McMullen share what has kept the flame burning through three decades of design. By Andrea Thorpe. Even after 30 years in the Western apparel industry, Audrey Franz and Cheryl McMullen, fearless leaders of the Double D Ranch brand, are still blazing a trail and have the stories to prove it. It was like 2 or 3 weeks before the Grammys, and she's like, "Oh yeah, I need something to wear," Franz recalls of one of the duo's recent adventures. The she in question is Tanya Tucker, by the way. Franz at McMullen custom outfitted her for the red carpet and after parties on music's biggest night. Reminiscing about the Grammy whirlwind produces many laughs as the sisters talk about the handmade suits lost in the mail, flying in a yard of fabric for last-minute alterations, and the grand festivity known as a celebrity dress fitting. The memories roll on from the Staples Center in Los Angeles to Broadway in Nashville, with Tucker still the main character. "We were shooting at her barn and her horses when they picked up a shirt and said, 'This needs to be shot on Broadway,'" McMullen recalls. "So she loads everybody up on her show bus, and I'm like, 'Oh my gosh, we're going downtown to Broadway with Tanya Tucker.'" These stories could reel in the attention of any country music admirer, but Franz and McMullen count them as another page of Double D Ranch history, a legacy they never knowingly set out to create. One anecdote they've told innumerable times is their origin story, a tale of an Indian blanket coat designed that unintentionally launched their iconic Western apparel brand. "We decided we were all going to go snow skiing in Taos on a super tight budget. I mean, we all piled into a 2-room motel room," McMullen recalls. "I came down off the mountain into Taos and got a glance of this man in the Indian blanket coat in the grocery store aisle. Later that night at the dinner table, McMullen brought up the coat sighting, catching the ear of a nearby table. This man from another table told me, 'Oh, run down to this store and he'll make you a blanket coat.' Following the man's advice, McMullen had her own blanket coat made and brought it back to Texas. As soon as her father saw the Southwestern souvenir, he told her to take the design to market. With the original maker's blessing, Franz and McMullen prepared to present the piece to market buyers. 'We had a great little presentation there at Dallas Market, and then it just took off,' McMullen says. 'We didn't even know what we were doing, but people were placing orders and it just got crazy.' With the hype of the original blanket coat still buzzing, people were already wondering what the sisters would be bringing to market next, even though they hadn't planned on returning. 'We were hoping to raise enough money to fund our ski trip for the next year, and that was it,' McMullen says with a laugh. While the birth of Double D Ranch wasn't planned, the growth of the brand was certainly not by accident. The sisters were raised authentically Western and have used their many adventures as creative fodder for fashion collections from season to season. In fact, the underlying themes of their 30th anniversary collection all pay homage to the people, places, and experiences dear to the Double D Ranch brand and those standing behind it. Dubbed "I Go Back," the fall collection is full of hidden significance from colorways to garment names. As McMullen elaborates, it's going back and looking at things that have influenced Double D Ranch for the past 30 years. What has influenced our design's aesthetic? What has put us here? In pondering that question, Franz and McMullen have dug into the roots of the journey to this milestone, noting every moment that signified a turning point or a nudge of encouragement in business as well as life. Some of these influences stem from their South Texas upbringing, with deep family connections to both the people and the land. Others come from an appreciation of culture discovered through years of study and travel. To understand how these broad themes materialize in well-thought-out design, one must only listen to Franz and McMullen explain the vision of each of the four collections within I Go Back. Matagorda. Matagorda basically represents Audrey, our sister, Hetty, and my growing up years. It's very 70s influence, as well as by the places we've traveled. Lots of quarter horse racing and Native American history comes in, and because we were so close to the Mexican border, Mexican influence comes in as well. Cody. Cody is based around not only Buffalo Bill Cody, the showman, but also a trip we took to Cody, Wyoming, to the Buffalo Bill Museum early in our business years. That trip and museum have influenced our aesthetic and design throughout the past 30 years. Nashville. Nashville is basically the soundtrack to us growing up. Not only the music coming out of Nashville, but also the outfits. Think nudie suits, things like that. Taos. Taos is where we originally started and got the blanket coat idea. The collection, again, is influenced by Native American blanket patterns, Millicent Rogers, and the Millicent Rogers Museum in Taos. While the design direction points to retro motifs in I Go Back, the collection is designed from a clean slate, no direct recreations. I didn't want to go back and repeat anything that we've done in the past, McMullen says. There are little nods throughout each collection to the original blanket coat or the original scout jacket. It will look familiar, but it will also look fresh. Even after 30 years of knockout collections, Double D Ranch continues to stump marketers with its ability to innovate and create in such a small niche as Western apparel. We've never been able to put a label on what Double D is, McMullen says. There is definitely a rock and roll influence to it. There's a Western influence to it. There's Spanish, Native American, Americana. It's a part of our heritage and who we are. It's truly our DNA. As for the woman wearing the clothes, McMullen has her more defined. I think she's a very strong, daring woman. I think she's not afraid to put on a jacket with fringe or a pair of statement boots. Our customer is not a wildflower. Nothing speaks to that definition of the Double D Ranch customer quite like the group of women Franz and McMullen have pulled together on social media, specifically concentrated on their Double D Addiction page on Facebook that boasts over 6,000 members. The Double D Addiction page has been really great for us to see real people wearing the clothes and seeing how they're putting things together, Franz says. Market research aside, the group has served as a meeting place for women and even a few men who admire the Double D Ranch brand and the culture around it. Members share favorite pieces from their personal collections, seek style advice, and get a first look at upcoming designs during live collection reveals. Real-life friendships have been developed as Addiction members travel together to Double D Ranch headquarters in Yoakum, Texas, or on group retreats throughout the year. To all who appreciate its no-wallflower culture that connects free-spirited women everywhere, the brand signifies something more than the clothes on their backs and the boots on their feet. It's the spirit of the West itself and the community it creates. Looking at what might lie ahead on the horizon of the next 30 years, Franz and McMullen seem steady in their vision. It's all about staying true to their roots, their quality, their Double D Ranch community, and the Western culture they lift up with each passing collection. Here's a travel article entitled, A Ranch for All Seasons. At Middle Creek Ranch, outside of Steamboat Springs, Colorado, heaven includes a well-appointed guest cabin, private chef, activity-filled days, star-filled nights, and 10,000 acres all to yourself. By Wendy Wilkinson. Driving onto the massive Middle Creek Ranch is like entering a Western wonderland. The gravel road that cuts through the 10,000-plus acres takes you past herds of grazing buffalo, cattle, and a horse facility with almost 24 very well-cared-for horses. The name comes from the creek formed by the convergence of three strongly flowing streams, the Little Middle, the Middle, and the North Fork. Nestled in Oak Creek, outside of Steamboat Springs, in Colorado's rich and fertile Yampa River Valley, the private and rentable ranch boasts Rocky Mountain beauty and a welcoming ranch compound reached at the end of the 4.6-mile drive. We're greeted by the property managers who show us to our two-bedroom, with a loft, log guest cabin. No scrimping on amenities here. From the freshly cut wildflowers on the front porch and kitchen counter, to the fridge stocked with cold beverages, to the Turkish towels and Egyptian cotton bedding. After we settle in for a bit, we get the grand tour in an open-air four-wheeler. One of the remarkable things about Middle Creek is the number of ecosystems on the canyon-rich ranch, from giant pine trees and tall aspens to acres of dense 6-foot-tall ferns that call to mind Jurassic Park. After a 3-hour tour, we return to the main lodge for a gourmet meal that the chef has prepared for us. After dinner, we almost rally for a soak in the hot tub, but we're just too contented right where we sit. The rest of the evening consists of rocking on the front porch, gazing into a star-filled sky, and listening to nothing but the quiet. After all the fresh air and with no light pollution sneaking in the windows, we sleep like babies. We wake up and ready ourselves for a hike, managing just a tiny fraction of the property on foot before we head off on an adventure we didn't even know was on our bucket list. We learn firsthand what caking the buffalo is all about as the ranch manager feeds 100 head of enthusiastic bison supplements near the open jeep where we sit slack-jawed and camera happy. One of the young calves seems to be thinking about jumping into the front seat with me. Nothing could be more magnificently removed from my normal day-to-day. Next, we're off to the barn where several of the horses are being brushed and then saddled, soon to be mounted by three female cowboys who will be riding out on the property to head off several head of cattle that have escaped from the herd. Then comes a fly fishing lesson. After several tries, I cast the fly deep into the center of the stocked pond, and although I don't catch anything, I feel truly alive in my own "a river runs through it" moment. Our heavenly time at Middle Creek Ranch passes way too quickly, even as it seems to slow down to a delightfully languid pace that really lets us savor the moments and connect with nature. Luckily, we can come back. Up to now, the ranch has been entirely private, but has recently opened for week-long retreats and celebrations for guests to rent out the whole 10,000 acres. The luxury price tag includes the spacious main house and two guest cabins, Altogether, they sleep 18 or more, as well as the lodge, a private chef for the week, and all ranch amenities, including shooting at the gun range, horseback riding, bicycling, four-wheeler tours, fly fishing, hiking, and use of the swimming hole with private deck. And don't forget, caking the buffalo. Stays at Middle Creek Ranch can be arranged through Explore Ranches, a private land experiential travel company that connects travelers with wild and scenic private properties and connects landowners with guides, musicians, program providers, archaeologists, astronomers, culinary experts, and other immersive travel outfitters. For more information and to see Explore Ranches' portfolio of properties, visit exploreranches.com. Here are a couple of articles from the section we call the Real West. All hat, no sound. Tom Mix was the silent screen's king of the cowboys, by Mike Kopuk. On the south side of town, in Oklahoma's former territorial capital of Guthrie, there's a building that once housed the Blue Bell Bar. Founded in 1889 in the wake of the land rush, it was one of Guthrie's most popular watering holes. But the saloon's main claim to fame might have less to do with its genesis and more to do with a certain one-time bartender. Before he found fame in Hollywood, the Blue Bell is where future Western silent movie star Tom Mix once poured drinks for real outlaws, real frontier marshals, and real gunfighters. A rumor goes around that on the east wall of the saloon once hung a life-size chart of Mix mapping the locations of 12 gunshot wounds and dozens more other bodily injuries from knife fights and broken bones he had sustained during his days as a cowhand and rodeo rider and as an actor doing his own stunts as one of the top male movie stars of the silent film era. The Pennsylvania-born Mix had drifted west into Oklahoma territory, working on the 101 ranch alongside Will Rogers, breaking horses and herding cattle. He had ended up in Oklahoma in 1902 after marrying his first wife, Grace Allen, that year. She didn't like his being in the service, so he went AWOL and they headed out west to escape the army. After leaving the Blue Bell and Guthrie, Mix turned up next as a performer in the 101 Ranch Wild West Show, where he debuted in 1905, dazzling audiences with his horsemanship and shooting skills. The birthplace of the show was the Miller Brothers 101 Ranch, a cattle operation that worked 110,000 acres in the Indian Territory of Oklahoma, and put on yearly rodeo extravaganzas that eventually expanded into the widely traveled Wild West Show. In its debut year, the show drew close to 80,000 attendees, with attractions that included Apache prisoner Geronimo, Buffalo Bill Cody, Bill Pickett, and Mix. That same year, probably due to his connection with the 101 Ranch Wild West Show, Mix rode in Theodore Roosevelt's inaugural parade with a cavalcade of Western cowboys. He continued amassing cowboy cred and resume lengtheners by winning national rodeo championships for riding and roping in 1909 and 1910. In 1910, Mix was asked to appear in the documentary Ranch Life in the Great Southwest. The film was a financial hit and launched a movie career that would ultimately boast some 366 westerns full of flashy stunts, fist fights, and shootouts that left audiences wanting more. You might say he was John Wayne before there was a John Wayne. Mix seemed suited to on-screen fiction and storytelling was in his blood. In real life, he was something of a fabulist. "He was the goddamnedest liar who ever lived," declared famed rodeo cowboy turned Hollywood stuntman Yakima Canutt. "But never did he lie to hurt anybody. It was always done in showmanship." Mix became the star of the Saturday afternoon matinees, in which the hero wore a white hat, kissed his horse, drank only sarsaparilla, and rescued women from a fate worse than death. If the plots were formulaic, his stunts weren't. His westerns stood out for death-defying exploits that saw Mix and his horse, Tony, leaping through glass windows and over deep gorges. The stunts kept his audiences enthralled. Mix, meanwhile, suffered mounting injuries. But the silent action suited Mix. His voice had been affected by a gunshot wound of the throat during his day's cowboying and from having his nose broken multiple times in bar fights. His films quickly made Mix one of the highest-paid actors in Hollywood, and he cut quite the famous figure off-screen as well. Flamboyantly dressed in his white 10-gallon hat, decorated boots, and a body-length coat, he had his initials lit up in neon lights on his ranch house outside of Los Angeles. His style and wealth were extravagant, and so were his marriages, 5 in a 30-year span. As the silent era came to a close, Mix was getting old, and his style of westerns had passed. When he asked friend John Ford for work, the famed director told him audiences now wanted something different. For a while, Mix found circuses lucrative. He made his last feature, the 15-chapter serial The Miracle Rider, in 1935. 5 years later, at age 60, he filled a custom aluminum briefcase-style suitcase with money, traveler's checks, and jewels, set it on the back seat of his yellow supercharged 1937 Cord 812 Phaeton convertible coupe, with an externally mounted spare tire on the rear deck, one of only two made, the other reportedly belonged to film legend Barbara Stanwyck, and headed east to visit old friends. 18 miles south of Florence, Arizona, he came up to barriers at a bridge washed out by flooding. Swerving twice, he finally overturned in a gully. The case flew forward, striking Mix from behind, breaking his neck, and killing him. Had it been a horse and not a car, and had the good guy survived, it would have been an ending fit for the motion pictures. You can find the case that killed him at the Tom Mix Museum, not in Guthrie, but in Dewey, Oklahoma, where Mix lived with his third wife, and where the museum has an 8.5 by 11 inch version of the chart showing his many and much mythologized gunshot wounds and other injuries. The Art Gallery. Michaela Jones. The great-great-granddaughter of Chief Tutawa of the Tossawitty Shoshone tribe, Michaela Jones has been creating works inspired by her Shoshone culture for more than two decades. She grew up on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation, 100 miles northeast of Elko, Nevada, and considers her rural upbringing and family heritage the foundation and inspiration for her vibrant work. An enrolled member of the Timok tribe of Western Shoshone, Joan calls herself a self-taught artist. She spent years trying different techniques, textures, and colors, painting what she saw in her mind's eye. Her goal is to connect with people through pieces that tell a story either about nature or her culture. Animals and totems are at the heart of her bold paintings, which are also available as signed and hand-embellished limited edition Gicklies. Joan's award-winning work has been shown across the country and is in the permanent collections of the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno, Nevada, and Northeastern Nevada Museum in Elko. Her work can also be seen at galleries in Red Lodge, Montana, and St. George, Utah. Some of her larger pieces are featured at the Four Seasons Resort, Rancho Encantado, Santa Fe. Also in Santa Fe, she was honored in 2017 with Indian Markets Design Fellowship Award, which saw her work emblazoned on all official market merchandise. We talked with Jones about her studio in Elko, where she was sheltering in place with her husband and their five children, and working on some personal pieces. CNI. You were raised on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation near Elko, Nevada. How have the cultural influences of your upbringing inspired your work? Michaela Jones. I feel so inspired and grounded when I'm there. The colors and styles I use are all inspired from growing up on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation, which is 100 miles from the nearest town. My dad and I always were hunting and fishing, and the valley we lived in was so beautiful. The colors I use are inspired from growing up there, and of course, from my grandmother's stories, even though she didn't have the opportunity to share her culture. Every time I paint something, I feel honored to paint the things that she could not express. Animals and totems are important to the Shoshone and Paiute nations, where you spent your youth. What animals have you most drawn upon in your work? I'm very drawn to buffalo. They are such majestic animals, powerful and very important to our tribe. One of our sons' middle name is Buffalo. I love their power, strength, and energy, and feel like I have a special connection with them, an almost symbiotic relationship. But I also have a growling tiger on my sight. When you and your family were sheltering in place last spring, you had time to return to several personal works that you'd been too busy to complete because you'd been consumed with shows and commission pieces. Tell us about one of the pieces you've been able to make time for. The canceling of Santa Fe Indian Market in August sort of took the wind out of my sails, and I used the month of April to regroup and went back to a mermaid piece that I had sketched out in 2017. We have property in Baja California near the water, and my daughter wanted me to paint us a mermaid using the shells we collected on the beach. This piece is totally outside the box for me, but I'm really enjoying it. Your work is so vibrant and textured. Tell us a bit about your technique and materials. I start with a sketch and then move on to texture. I primarily paint with acrylics. I then layer with gesso and take different tools, including palette, knives, combs, and even hairdryer attachments. This process produces a lot of light and captures the glow from within, which is especially evident in my teepee pieces. In addition to your original work, you also sell limited edition Giklis with band detailing. What made you decide to branch out into Giklis? This is an affordable option for collectors who may not be able to afford my original work. Each piece is gallery wrapped. I personally embellish each piece, and we can frame them as well. Late 2020 seems like it's going to be a very exciting time for you. I understand you have a clothing line in the works. After last year's Indian Market, several of us Plains Indians were approached to work on a fashion line based on our work, and that's moving forward. I have my art printed on fabric already, am working on jackets as well, and anticipate we will have our first fashion show in the late fall. I am also working on my 2021 calendar, which always sells out in the first month of the year. Z.S. Liang. It's a long way from childhood poverty in the 1950s China of Chairman Mao to the American dream in the affluent Los Angeles suburb of Agoura Hills. The talented paintbrush of Z.S. Liang has taken him on that remarkable journey. Today, that artistic trek takes viewers of his award-winning oil paintings back in time for a close-up look at the lives of the Plains Indians of the 19th century. I try to record the Indian as a hero, as a positive figure, Liang says at his home studio. Whereas Frederick Remington's narratives featured frontiersmen caught in a desperate last stand, Liang's focus is on the native warriors encircling those intruders in a desperate fight for their very way of life. The images are packed with historical detail, like the circle a brave would paint around the eye of his war horse. That means a horse can see better, Liang explains. The stripes on a horse mean counting coup, touch the enemy. All this indicates a great chief, not an ordinary person. Liang has been drawing since he was old enough to pick up a pencil. Creativity was in his genes. His father was an artist, his mother a musician. As a boy of six, his drawing of a local celebration was published in a magazine. That was in 1959, during an era of limited and suspicion-filled relations with communist China. But as a child, Liang never felt oppressed. When you live there, you don't feel it, he says. Later on, when I came here, I saw the difference. He attended Beijing's Central Academy of Fine Arts before coming to America in 1982 to pursue a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Painting at Massachusetts College of Art and an MFA in Painting at Boston University. But the following decade, the future American citizen was a successful and award-winning portrait and commercial artist. A visit to a living history museum outside of Boston would forever change the focus of Liang's art and the direction of his life. At the Plymouth Plantation, he was fascinated by Native Americans realistically portraying the Wampanoag Indians of the 1600s. It opened a new world, Liang says, and from there I just learned so much about the Indian. His work ever since has focused primarily on the final century of the free-roaming Lakota, Arapaho, Blackfeet, and Cheyenne, those traumatic years of change on the Great Plains between the days of Lewis and Clark and the final shots of the Indian Wars. The painter has visited many reservation homelands of those tribes, met their elders, and participated in their ceremonies. Adorning his home studio are pieces collected on those trips that look as if they date from the 1800s. The buckskin war shirts, headdresses, modified Winchesters, medicine bags, and other items serve as accurate models and lend the authenticity that pervades Liang's canvases. Most are recreations made by modern native artists, but Liang has even made some replicas himself. I have to learn to make them to understand their way of life, he says. I try to make everything as real as possible. All the customs, the details. As much as possible, it's real. Liang's paintings take you inside the villages, the lodges, and the families of that bygone era, portraying the people who followed the buffalo as the unique individuals they were. He might paint a young family in a busy village showing off their newborn son, a grandfather encouraging a departing soldier warrior, or a mother teaching her young daughter to sew. Domestic scenes like these give way to representations of the dramatic conflict that once raged across the plains. A painting that portrays a galloping decoy of horseback warriors leading the hated bluecoats into a trap brings to mind something Sitting Bull's great-grandson Ernie LaPointe observed about Liang's work. The strokes of his paintbrush tell our story. Z.S.'s paintings capture the true images of his subjects. You'll find these words in Z.S. Lang, Native Trails, Fresh Tracks, the first retrospective book on the artist. In its pages and on his canvases, you can still travel back to the days when the buffalo and those who followed them were free. The Carroll Legacies and Diverse Descendants. The North American cowboy doesn't encompass just one custom or image, but includes a whole range of traditions and cultures. That's the photogenic point of a new exhibition of roughly 50 photographs at Booth Western Art Museum. Showcasing the many variations on the cowboy theme, it traces the legacy of the first cowboys through many expressions of the Western tradition, highlighting Mexican charros, Indian relay races, and rodeos, Hawaiian paniolas, as well as black rodeos and African-American cowboys. The history of the North American cowboy can be traced back to the early Spanish horsemen, the vaqueros, who brought their craft and traditions to the Americas in 1867, says Booth Curator of Photography Dr. Samuel Drace III. Since then, cowboy culture can be found from the east to the west coast of the United States, and even in Hawaii. This exhibition is a celebration of those diverse descendants, spanning rodeos to ranching and those in between. Museum Executive Director Seth Hopkins knew of a number of talented photographers who were delving into the cowboy lifestyle, the cowboy mystique, the cowboy way. All different types of people who wound up being cowboys and who might have different lingo and different dress, but were essentially all doing the same job, but doing it differently. The idea for an exhibition that would capture those varied manifestations through the lenses of multiple photographers became Vaquero Legacies and Diverse Descendants. The show features a great cross-section of America, Hopkins says, and brings together color and black and white images from contemporary photographers such as Richard Ducree, Jay Desard, Colin Erie, Antonio Gomez, Anouk Kranz, Nadine Levin, Barbara Van Cleve, Travis Gillett, Ivan McClellan, Julia Coombs, Rosianna Sales, Christopher Pugmire, with filmmaker Doug Hancock, and others. Hopkins, an especially drawn to the work of Kranz. She's from France and comes to it a real outsider with the romantic ideas of a European thinking of the cowboy ideal. Then, after being exposed to the real thing, she found that it wasn't what she thought it was. The authentic blue-collar American, patriotic with all these ideals that a cynical city person in Europe thought was a cliché, is real, or more real than anything that could ever have been in her mind. For Drace, it's difficult to pick a favorite. The photographers in the exhibition each document the breadth of cowboy culture in their own special way. To me, what is striking about the artists, and indeed the exhibition, is their unique styles and subjects. Anouk Kranz transforms the western sky into a huge expanse through the use of stark contrast. Colin Erie documents the Compton Cowboys, blending aspects of documentary and editorial photography to celebrate this group of African Americans as they work to educate and inspire future generations. Richard Ducree uses color and black and white photography to highlight the blend of African, African American, and Western traditions among riders in black rodeos. There's also the work of Antonio Gomez, a photography professor at College of Southern Nevada, whose crisp black and whites of the charrea is a Mexican version of rodeo. Document participants and spectators, charros' traditional clothing, and the vibrant atmosphere of the events. the ways in which long-lived traditions are passed on from generation to generation is central to Gomez's series, Drace says. His work shows the struggle of many Mexican immigrants who make it their mission to pass on equestrian precision and human nobility to the next generation. When you see all of the diverse images together in one exhibition, Drace says, a more holistic picture of the American cowboy begins to emerge. Bear Pascoe's Second Dream. When he retired from the NFL, this Super Bowl-winning tight end immediately started working toward his next goal, a rodeo championship. By Michael J. Mooney. Bear Pascoe knew he had not played well in his last preseason game. The journeyman tight end only had a few weeks to learn the complex New England Patriots offense, so he understood there was a chance he'd get cut again. When he saw someone from the team's front office making his way around the locker room the morning after his bad game, Pascoe started packing up his stuff. His career as a professional football player was over. That was 2016, and by then Pascoe, who's 6'5" and north of 260 pounds, had been cut by four other teams. Originally drafted in the sixth round out of California State University, Fresno, by the San Francisco 49ers in 2009, he was waived before his first season started. Pascoe signed with the New York Giants and played there for the better part of five seasons, including in Super Bowl 46, when he caught four passes in a 21-17 victory over the Patriots. But then he had bounced around the league for a few years. He played a season in Atlanta, then signed a one-year deal with Chicago before getting cut at the end of training camp. He signed with the Detroit Lions and played a few games with them at the end of the 2015 season. Pascoe remembers the New England coaches wishing him well, then putting him on a plane heading home to the central coast of California within a few hours. That night, he was in his father-in-law's rodeo arena wrestling steer with local college kids. "I always knew when I was done with football, I'd dive into rodeo," Pascoe says. "So when I saw them practicing, I just put my boots on and joined them." By then, he'd been married to his wife Katie for 3 years, but they'd been together for seven. He says early on in their relationship, he told her that he had two dreams in life: winning a Super Bowl, and winning a National Finals Rodeo steer wrestling title. Now he's working on that second dream. On the day we talk, Pascoe has been working at his wife's family's ranch near San Luis Obispo. He woke up early this morning to feed the horses and clean some horse pens. Then he pushed a heavy trencher through a pasture where he wants to add a sprinkler line. From the highest point on the property, you can see the nearby beach and ocean. But Pascoe doesn't go down there often. Most of his time is spent here, working and practicing. He grew up not far away, the son of a ranch foreman in California's Central Valley. His given name is McKenna, but people have called him Bear most of his life. He had chores to do each morning before he went to school. Then came chores when he got home each afternoon. "My childhood wasn't any different than any ranch kid," he says. "Working hard right next to grown men, learning how to work really hard. That gave me the work ethic to succeed on the football field." When he was a boy, he competed in local team roping events, but as he grew bigger and stronger, he knew playing football would get him a college scholarship. He played quarterback in high school and switched to tight end at Fresno State, where he still holds records for both most touchdown receptions in a game and most field goals blocked in a career. He played 85 games as a pro, regularly battling future Hall of Fame linebackers and defensive ends. None of it came easy, but he studied tape relentlessly, practiced hard consistently, and persisted even when he faced major career setbacks. Meanwhile, rodeo was always in the back of his mind. When his NFL days were done, Pascoe turned to his father-in-law, John W. Jones, Jr., for coaching. Both Jones and his father, J.W. Jones, are rodeo legends and world champion steer wrestlers. Pascoe started working his ground game, his technique in the arena. A few months later, in early 2017, the former tight end jumped his first steer, and he took a rough tumble. By his third or fourth attempt, though, Pascoe was able to catch the steer and throw him down. By the end of that year, he was competing in rodeos. The next year, he entered more, even winning an event in Reno, Nevada, with a $95,220 purse. He says that, like football, steer wrestling comes down to technique. As valuable as his size and strength might be, bulldogging is more about style and instinct in the moment. You get out there and trust that technique to take over. Of course, in football practice, you can slow down a play. A coach can walk a player through a block or a route step by step, then drill those motions over and over until the whole thing becomes ingrained, second nature. You can't do that with a live steer. You can't ask a steer to stand still as you figure out the best way to turn its head, Pascoe says. The mental preparation is also similar. You know that the work period leading up to that point, you've done everything you can, Pascoe says. So you can just go out there and react. Go have fun with it. As with his football career, there have been setbacks in his pursuit of a steer wrestling championship. Plenty of rodeos where he took chances didn't pay off. And just like he did in his football career, Pascoe has persevered. He says his wife, a champion barrel racer herself, is his biggest fan, and his father-in-law keeps him focused. Johnny is good about reminding me not to overthink things, Pascoe says. He keeps everything simple. Pascoe knows that not everything will go his way. Cowboying, like so many other things in life, takes work. There are no shortcuts to success. So, after talking for an hour or so about his journey from ranch kid to Super Bowl champion to professional steer wrestler, Pascoe has to go. He has more horse pens to clean. Best of the Big Screen West. Take 4. To celebrate films, filmmakers, and film stars of special interest to CNI readers, we're presenting the 4th annual edition of the CNI Movie Awards. Vote for your favorites at cowboysindians.com/movieawards by Joe Layden. Much like the organizers of most other movie awards during the year of COVID-19, we've had to make some adjustments to our voting process. Because we traditionally limit the list of qualified films to those that receive at least limited theatrical and/or festival exposure, and to be honest, during 2020, some of that exposure was extremely limited, we have 4 nominations in each category instead of the usual 5. On the other hand, we've added a brand new category this year, Best Documentary. That's where you'll find 4 exceptional nonfiction features that focus on the first wife of the legendary Johnny Cash, Matt Riddlehoover's My Darling Vivian, the creative processes of music, City, Tunesmith's It All Began with the Say Songs, the story of the Nashville songwriter, the challenging lives of contemporary cowboys, Bud Force and John Longmire's Cowboys, a documentary portrait, and the musical tastes of our 39th U.S. President, Murray Wharton's Jimmy Carter, Red and Rock and Roll President, which, despite its title, also includes testimonials from country artists like Willie Nelson, Larry Gatlin, and Garth Brooks. Of course, it wouldn't be a C&I Movie Awards celebration if our readers didn't have the final word in the selection process. So we're asking you to visit cowboysandindians.com and cast your vote for your favorite in each category. We're also seeking your nominations for the greatest Western film of all time. You'll be able to write in your all-time favorite, and we'll be revealing an updated ranking of classic Westerns later this year. The deadline for submitting your picks in the C&I Movie Awards will be Wednesday, March 3rd. Winners will be announced Friday, March 5th. Vote at cowboysindians.com/movieawards. Vote now. Among the dramatic features with multiple nominations are five movies. First Cow, a critically acclaimed period drama from Mex Cutoff director Kelly Reichardt, about two improbably matched partners who hit upon a novel way to milk opportunities and make their fortune in the 19th century Oregon Territory. Let Him Go. C&I reader faves Kevin Costner and Diane Lane star to perfection in Thomas Bazooka's slow burn thriller as a Montana couple driven to extremes while trying to retrieve their grandchild from an off-the-grid clan in the Dakotas. News of the World. Tom Hanks reunites with Captain Phillips director Paul Greengrass for the Oscar-winning actor's first Western, the story of a Civil War veteran who signs on to return a youngster, Helena Zingle, raised by Kiowa, to her biological family. Nomadland. For her follow-up to The Rider, director Chloe Zhao offers another masterful entwining of fact and fiction while focusing on a strong-willed woman, two-time Oscar winner Frances McDormand, who packs her van and begins a nomadic life in the American West. And Yellow Rose, a Filipina teen, Eva Nobolzada, in Bastrop, Texas, develops a taste and talent for country music and winds up being mentored by veteran country artist Dale Watson, played in a bold stroke of casting by Dale Watson, in Diane Paraga's contemporary drama. Here are the nominees. Best Picture, First Cow, Let Him Go, News of the World, Nomadland. Best Director, Thomas Bazooka, Let Him Go, Paul Greengrass, News of the World, Kelly Reichardt, First Cow, Chloe Zhao, Nomadland. Best Actor, Kevin Costner, Let Him Go, Tom Hanks, News of the World, Harrison Ford, The Call of the Wild, John Magaro, First Cow. Best Actress, Eva Nobilzada, Yellow Rose, Diane Lane, Let Him Go, Frances McDormand, Nomadland, Helen Zinga, News of the World. Best Supporting Actor, Gary Farmer, First Cow, Orion Lee, First Cow, David Strathairn, Nomadland, Dale Watson, Yellow Rose. Best Supporting Actress, Kaylee Carter, Let Him Go, Leslie Manville, Let Him Go, Linda May, Nomadland, Princess Punzalan, Yellow Rose. Best Screenplay, Thomas Bazooka, Let Him Go, Paul Greengrass and Luke Davies, News of the World. Kelly Reichardt and Jonathan Raymond, First Cow. Chloe Zhao, Nomadland. And Best Documentary, Cowboys, A Documentary Portrait. It all begins with a song, the story of the Nashville songwriter. Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President. And finally, My Darling Vivian. Here are two Western storefronts. 4-6's Ranch. Cowboy life in the wide open Wild West doesn't seem such a bygone era when you visit 4-6's Ranch and Supply House in rural Guthrie, Texas. The acclaimed 4-6's Ranch, established in 1870, opened its supply house in 1900 to offer ranch workers the only place where they could get provisions. The mercantile still provides that service to the community today, offering groceries and fuel. And the draw of cowboy culture has made Supply House a nostalgic and historic stop for many tourists hoping to get a taste of ranch life, maybe the chance to strike up a conversation with a real ranch-working cowboy or cowgirl. If you are familiar with the ranch, I think it's just one of those must-do things when you go through that area, says Brandy Blodgett Mustian, the 4-6's Ranch's branded product manager. Sentiments of the old-fashioned general store are still as alive as they were in 1900, like the old cash register and some of the store's original fixtures on display. Cowboy hats of past 4-6's workers even adorn the walls. For those wanting to take a piece of the ranch home with them, the store offers 4-6's originals, collections such as the charcuterie boards milled from the ranch's own wood, boots designed by the ranch's cowboys and cowgirls through a collaboration with Finoglio Boots, and products handcrafted by Texas craftsmen, many of them 4-6's ranch workers, who are also skilled artisans. The other Western storefront is Nuevo Rancho. Days on the ranch mean a lot of time on your feet. Your boots should help, rather than hinder, your rising step count. That's the sentiment that prompted Coco Gonzalez, owner and creative director of Nuevo Rancho, to shift her high fashion focus from studying fashion design in college to something that hit closer to home. We come from West Texas, Gonzalez says. My family and I would wear boots all the time, and our feet would hurt after wearing those $400 to $500 boots. Nuevo Rancho, meaning new ranch, was conceptualized as a new alternative on the Western footwear scene, offering more affordable boots that won't sit unused in a closet due to lack of comfort. Our company is actually a Christian-based business. Every boot is stamped with Jeremiah 29:11, Gonzalez says. We're honest people. We do honest pricing. The brand gained popularity through pop-up shops and as a vendor on the rodeo circuit before getting its own storefront in the historic Fort Worth Stockyards. Store employees aim to treat customers like family, all while sharing product knowledge and helping shoppers create a winning look. We're trying to make customers feel comfortable, says co-owner Teresa Morales. We're not pressuring them. While already complementing its boots with clothing and accessories from other vendors, Nuevo Rancho is quickly expanding its own designs to include hats and clothing. You might come into this store as a customer, but you're sure to walk out in comfort, in style, and as family.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.